Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the African American community. This week is the last of three programs dedicated to the United States semi-quincentennial. I'll have readings from Harvard Magazine about an early abolitionist, the news website NorthJersey.com about Revolutionary War soldiers. I'll be reading an essay from Ms. Magazine about one of the women owned by George Washington. There's a story about Lord Dunmore's Emancipation Proclamation from Cardinal News in Virginia, and a report on current thoughts about the Declaration of Independence from the Our Times Press News out of Brooklyn, New York. And I'm starting with this out of the Hartford Current newspaper and its current.com website, C-O-U-R-A-N-T. It's titled, Connecticut Passed Laws That Pushed Enslaved People Into the Revolutionary War. It Could Bring Freedom. This was written by Calista Oitama and published July 4, 2026. At least 500 of Connecticut's estimated 35,000 soldiers serving in the Revolutionary War were black, according to military records. One of these men, forcibly taken from either Africa or South America to Connecticut in the mid-1700s, was a physician known as Dr. Cuff Saunders, C-U-F-F-S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S. Saunders' occupation was rare. Black soldiers often worked as cooks, orderlies, and trench diggers. Before the war, Saunders had been bound to an apothecary in Colchester and a doctor in Hartford, records show. He enlisted as a private in the 4th Connecticut Regiment in 1777 to earn his freedom. His medical skills likely caught the attention of his commanding officers, as he spent most of his service in Danbury assisting Philip Turner, Surgeon General of the Army's Eastern Division, with medical procedures and preparing medicine. Historical data compiled by Forgotten Voices reveals that Saunders and 180 other known black or indigenous soldiers were also stationed at the Reading Encampment, sometimes referred to as Connecticut's Valley Forge. From June to September 1778, personnel documents also describe Saunders as attending the sick at the actual Valley Forge in Pennsylvania. In 1777, Connecticut passed two laws that incentivized slave owners to send black soldiers into war. Any two men who could procure an able-bodied soldier for enlistment were exempted from the draft. And slave owners who freed enslaved people were no longer required to financially support them. Taken together, a slave owner could promise an enslaved person freedom in exchange for serving in his stead, without being liable for his former dependent after the war. Kevin Johnson, a member of the Connecticut State Library's History and Genealogy Department, has portrayed black historical figures involved in the Revolutionary and Civil Wars for 28 years. He draws on extensive archival research to ensure audiences leave feeling the humanity of the individual. Johnson cited freedom as the main reason black soldiers enlisted, but emphasized the many meanings of the word. Their own personal freedom definitely was the main reason, he said. For some, it was patriotism for the land that enslaved them. They were willing to die for it. During the war, many enslaved soldiers began dropping the last names of their enslavers and choosing their own. Last names such as Freeman, Freedom, and Liberty pepper historical records reflecting the promise of freedom extended to enslaved soldiers by slave owners and the revolution alike. But life after the war revealed the limits of freedom without support. Most people did receive their manumission and were free, but they didn't really have anywhere to go because they didn't have any wealth or extensive family ties, said Donna Meyer, digital projects manager at the Connecticut League of Museums. So freedom could also mean losing a lot. Instead, like white soldiers, older black soldiers eventually applied for pensions. 63% of pension applications cataloged by the Connecticut State Library were submitted in 1820, soon after Congress expanded eligibility for Revolutionary War pensions. Words related to family appeared in 297 summaries of pension applications. Many applicants cited a need to provide for their family or having no family who could support them. Disability was the second most mentioned category. Applicants were feeble, blind, or simply unable to work. Saunders died from influenza in 1788. In 1837, his wife Phyllis, twice widowed, applied for a pension. It took 6 years for her application to pass, perhaps due to administrative lags or skepticism surrounding her marriage to Saunders. She collected dozens of pages of affidavits from respected white members of the community, all of whom confirmed Saunders' period of service in the war and the validity of his marriage to his wife. In 1843, age 95, she finally received a pension of $80 a year. Johnson marveled at the humanity present in primary source documents that are often understudied. He said that piecing together the stories of soldiers such as Saunders, along with his own reenactment work, were part of a larger project by Black Americans to write ourselves back into history. Though 3 decades have passed, Johnson remembers his first reenactment with clarity. It was February 10, 1998. Clad head to toe in military dress, he strode into a University of Connecticut classroom as Civil War fighter William Webb, singing a spiritual to students unfamiliar with the story he was about to tell. Said, "I'm free, praise the Lord. I'm free, no longer bound. No more chains holding me." "Even if the people don't remember every word I said," Johnson said, "they would have known that Connecticut had Black soldiers that fought in the Civil War and the Revolutionary War." That was the Hartford Current newspaper story titled, "Connecticut Passed Laws That Pushed Enslaved People into the Revolutionary War. It Could Bring Freedom." This was written by Callista Oitama and published July 4th, 2026. My next reading is titled, "How the American Revolution Freed a Future Abolitionist." This was written by Lydia Lyle Gibson and published April 9, 2026 in Harvard Magazine. Darby Vassall, V-A-S-S-A-L-L, a prominent Black leader and abolitionist in the early years of the American Republic, found his freedom during the Revolution, almost by default. In 1775, he was 6 years old and enslaved to a man named George Reed in South Woburn, Massachusetts. When Reed was killed that June at the Battle of Bunker Hill, Vassall simply walked away. He made his way back to the place where he'd been born, the Cambridge estate of sugar magnate John Vassall, Jr., known today as the Longfellow House, Washington's headquarters National Historic Site. There, Darby Vassall's parents and siblings had been living for nearly a year in a similar state of legally murky emancipation after Loyalist John Vassall and his family fled town, leaving behind a household of enslaved people. "It's a very New England kind of narrative," says social anthropologist Carla Martin, a lecturer in African and African American studies who recently co-led a 3-year research project on the Black history of the Vassall estate. "We're still getting a sense of how common this was elsewhere, but in the Boston area, there were many freed Black people who either self-emancipated at this time, walking away from the shops, homes, and farms where they were enslaved, or were abandoned by Loyalists and emancipated by default. And then they lived in this limbo for a period of time. Slavery effectively ended in Massachusetts in 1783. After a series of legal suits on behalf of former slaves seeking manumission." Darby Vassall's family spent the better part of the Revolution living in a small building on the estate and farming on a small plot of land there. The 105-acre estate stretched from today's Brattle Street to the Charles River. For a time, they shared the property with a very famous figure. In July 1775, during the Siege of Boston, George Washington arrived in Cambridge to take command of the Continental Army. After a brief stay in Wadsworth House on Harvard's campus, he moved into John Vassall's mansion, which served as his headquarters until April 1776. No records indicate that Darby Vassall's parents, Anthony, sometimes called Tony, and Cuba Vassall, worked for Washington, but there is an account perhaps apocryphal, about a run-in with young Darby. The story goes that Washington saw the child swinging on the mansion's gate one day and instructed him to go inside, where he'd be given work and something to eat. To Washington's surprise, Darby Fasall responded by asking what he would be paid. According to Samuel Francis Batchelder, a Cambridge area historian who published a report on the encounter in 1917, Darby Fasall insisted for the rest of his life that Washington was no gentleman for having expected him to work without wages. There is something else very New England and very Harvard about Darby Fasall's story. The slaveholding Fasalls were among many white families who amassed fortunes as sugar planters in the Caribbean and then built mansions in the Northeast. These families helped shape early Harvard as trustees, donors, and students. Several Fasall sons attended the university, and the family was so wealthy, says Martin, that on at least one occasion they paid their tuition with a chest of sugar. Darby Fasall's father was first enslaved as a young adult on a Fasall plantation in Jamaica. In the decades leading up to the Revolution, Britain's Caribbean colonies were convulsed with a series of major slave uprisings. Perhaps the most significant was Tacky's Revolt in 1760, which engulfed Jamaica, including the Fasall plantations, at a moment when defiance against the crown was building in New England. It's largely forgotten by Americans today, but the connection between anti-colonial violence in the Caribbean and the growing unrest in Massachusetts would not have been lost on loyalists like the Fasall, says Vincent Brown, Warren Professor of American History and a professor of African and African American Studies, who recounted the insurrection in Tacky's Revolt, the story of an Atlantic slave war. The Fasalls were related by marriage to the Royals, R-O-Y-A-L-L-S, another family with plantations in the Caribbean and mansions in Massachusetts. Isaac Royal Jr. endowed Harvard's first law professorship, and until 2016, the family crest was used as the Harvard Law School shield. Darby Fasall's mother was born on a royal plantation on the island of Antigua, and later bequeathed a royal daughter who married into the Fasall family. Like his in-laws, Isaac Royal Jr. was a loyalist. He fled to England before the Revolution. After he died in 1781, an enslaved woman named Belinda Sutton, whom he'd left behind in his Medford, Massachusetts home and freed in his will, petitioned the Commonwealth for a pension from his estate, using the language of the Revolution to argue against the ignoble servitude of slavery. Around that same time, Darby Fasall's parents made similar petitions to the Massachusetts legislature, also using revolutionary rhetoric to argue successfully for annual compensation from the Fasall estate, which the government had seized. As an adult, Darby Fasall joined Beacon Hill's Free Black Community, and in 1796, he and his brother Cyrus formed the African Society of Boston, a fraternal organization advocating on behalf of the city's black population. Among other activities, it raised funds for an African school for children and adults and sponsored lectures on the history of enslavement. An activist throughout his life, Darby Fasall was a guest of honor at an 1858 abolitionist commemoration of the Boston Massacre. In 1861, he joined his daughter and son-in-law in signing a petition, now housed in the Harvard Archives, asking the Massachusetts legislature to protect black people in the Commonwealth from fugitive slave laws. He died later that year at age 92, just months after the outbreak of the Civil War. He was buried, in accordance with his expressed wishes, beneath the sanctuary floor of Cambridge's Christ Church, in the same crypt with the Fasalls, who had once enslaved his family. His resting place was only discovered a few years ago by then-student Nicole Pippenbrink, as she was conducting research for her master's thesis. The reasons he chose this spot remain unknown, but Darby knew who he was, says Denise Washington, a fourth-generation descendant. In 2024, she joined Martin's research team and a group of other descendants on a trip to Jamaica and Antigua, to visit the sites where Darby Vassal's parents were enslaved. Last year, she began organizing In Search of Darby Vassal tours in Cambridge and Boston. I honestly think, she says, that he knew that by being buried there, he would be found. He knew we would find him. That was the article, How the American Revolution Freed a Future Abolitionist, written by Lydia Lyle Gibson and published at the HarvardMagazine.com website on April 9, 2026. Next, I have an essay from Ms. Magazine. It's titled, She Wanted to Be Free, Black Women's Revolutionary Resistance. This was written by Vanessa Holden and published March 26, 2026. The name Ona Judge should sound familiar. She was one of at least 9 enslaved people owned by Martha and George Washington, who are highlighted in the President's House exhibit, which opened in 2010, a short distance from the Liberty Bell Center in Philadelphia. The exhibit was recently dismantled by National Park Service employees on January 22, 2026. The fact of Judge's enslavement, alongside Hercules, Maul, Giles, Austin, Richmond, Paris, Joe, Christopher Shields, and William Lee, seemed to conflict with the current administration's 2025 executive order, Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, which targets those exhibits perceived to divide Americans based on race. Despite these efforts, which have also resulted in the city of Philadelphia bringing a lawsuit against the federal government, the names of the 9 remain chiseled in stone nearby. Ona Judge is the subject of Erica Armstrong Dunbar's award-winning book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Born around 1774, the year the British Crown subjected the 13 colonies to the Intolerable Acts, Judge grew up with the new nation. In 1784, the same year the Treaty of Paris ended the Revolutionary War, Ona Judge became Martha Washington's personal maid. As such, she traveled to wait on Miss Washington at the nation's new capital, first in New York City, then in Philadelphia. At the end of Washington's presidency, the first family prepared to return to Mount Vernon, their Virginia plantation. Ona Judge prepared to flee and live free. She was not alone. Judge relied on networks within and between free black communities. Her refusal to remain enslaved was part of a much larger black liberation movement that existed before, during, and after the American Revolution. African American women and their communities did not need the Enlightenment or the Age of Revolutions to teach them about human rights. Enslaved women had argued for their freedom, and free women of color had argued for their social and political equality for generations, by the time the revolutionary rhetoric took hold in the British North American colonies that became the United States. To erase from an exhibit the names of those who labored in bondage for the nation's first president may obscure Washington's participation in the national sin of slavery. But it also leaves visitors with the impression that those 9 were the only laborers. Judge's life story and the story of thousands of other black women argue the opposite. Enslaved and free people offered far more sophisticated interpretations of the Enlightenment principles that slaveholders touted. Black women made clear daily that remaining in bondage was not their preferred state, and enslavers knew and acknowledged this readily apparent fact. Enslavers throughout Britain's North American colonies passed laws and slave codes that instituted severe physical punishment for resistance and rebellion. Still, black women sued enslavers for their freedom. Sometimes they poisoned, set ablaze, or found other means to murder their enslavers. They fled from their households and plantations, even if for only a short time. Black women slowed down work. They grew their own gardens. They helped sustain their communities despite the ever-looming prospect of sale. They raised children, their own and their enslavers. Black women heard what Euro-Americans proclaimed in town squares, public houses, on the docks and in the warehouses and in their churches. and the notion of natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness sounded like what black women had been demanding, petitioning for, and even stealing all along. Elizabeth Freeman offers an example of the liberatory power of black women's political thought. Freeman was enslaved in Massachusetts by Colonel John Ashley, a prominent magistrate and patriot. As an older woman, she recalled how she daily resisted her enslaver's wife, Hannah Ashley. When Freeman stepped in to spare her younger sister from the violence at the hands of Miss Ashley, Ashley beat her across the arm with a fire iron, leaving a gash that formed into a gruesome scar. When asked about her arm in years to come, Freeman would reply, "Ask Madam." Remembered as intelligent, principled, and formidable, Elizabeth Freeman did not mince words about her claim to freedom. As an elderly woman, she stated, "Any time while I was a slave, if 1 minute's freedom had been offered to me and I had been told I must die at the end of that minute, I would have taken it. Just to stand 1 minute on God's earth, a free woman, I would." At the time of the American Revolution, her enslaver was actively involved in resisting the British crown. Her position in the Ashley household as an enslaved woman would have made her unremarkable to her enslaver's prominent guests, whose political discussions she listened to while waiting on them. During her daily labor, she heard the news of the day. She relied on others reading texts like the then-new Massachusetts Constitution aloud. Ratified in 1780, the Massachusetts Constitution clearly stated, "All men are born free and equal, and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights." Much to her enslaver's shock, Freeman sought the help of Theodore Sedgwick, a Revolutionary War veteran, politician, and lawyer, and boldly argued that she was included in the new Constitution. Sedgwick agreed. In late August 1781, roughly 1 month before the Battle of Yorktown that ended the Revolutionary War would begin in Virginia, Freeman won her case by unanimous judgment. She was not the first to sue for her freedom, nor was she the only enslaved person to petition and sue for her freedom during the American Revolution, but her argument was revolutionary in its simplicity. Casting aside the name she'd been called in slavery, Mum Bett, and claiming Elizabeth Freeman as her new name, she began her life in freedom just as the United States won its final victory over Britain. Her lawsuit is also credited with abolishing slavery in Massachusetts. When Elizabeth Freeman was fighting for her freedom in Massachusetts courts, thousands of enslaved people had already struck out for freedom on foot. All over the 13 colonies, enslaved people chose to take the British up on their offer of freedom in exchange for service to the crown. When British officials offered freedom to enslaved people who defected, they envisioned able-bodied young men leaving farms and plantations to serve in the British Army. Their decision was not the result of abolitionist sentiment, but military practicalities. British colonial officials saw an opportunity to deprive American colonists of much-needed black labor, to bolster their ranks, and to scare enslavers with the prospect of facing their former slaves in battle. To their surprise, black women, children, and elders began arriving in family and kinship groups along with black men, fully prepared to claim their liberty. Whatever British commanders intended stood no chance in the face of black women's political theory and praxis. If the British offered freedom, the women would claim it. When the war ended, the British could not evacuate everyone who wanted to leave with them. In all, about 9,000 managed to leave the United States with evacuating troops. Ona Judge, enslaved by Martha Washington as part of her late husband's estate, faced the end of the Revolutionary War with no hope for emancipation in sight. In her native Virginia, the war led many to flee slavery with varying levels of success. When the Treaty of Paris was signed in 1784, ending the Revolutionary War, Judge, then 10 years old, became Martha Washington's personal maid. Like Elizabeth Freeman, Judge had ears. The rhetoric of the Revolution and the vaunted place the Washingtons occupied as the first president and first lady of the United States. She also would have known that some states were working to abolish slavery or gradually emancipate enslaved people. Virginia was not one of those states. Instead, enslavers in Virginia were actively ramping up the transatlantic slave trade to replenish the laborers lost during the war years. Individual enslavers sometimes emancipated their slaves or made provisions for their manumission in their wills. But for states like Virginia that relied heavily on enslaved people's labor, revolutionary principles were not enough to inspire a statewide manumission law. No, Ona Judge knew that she would one day be inherited by Martha Washington's descendants. George Washington did make provisions for the emancipation of his human property at the end of his life. Martha Washington, though, fully intended to execute her first husband's will and ensure the wealth and inheritance of her children. Though Pennsylvania began a program of gradual manumission in 1780, the Washingtons were careful to make sure the enslaved members of their household never resided in the state for more than 6 months, allowing them to avoid having to free any of them. The Washingtons were clear. Enslaved people like Ona Judge would bolster the Custis estate for generations. Like Freeman, Judge's labor took her into the local community, where she met and knew free black Philadelphians. As a member of the president's household, she would have heard constant talk of the early nation's attempt to live up to its principles. When it came time for the Washingtons to leave Pennsylvania and return to Virginia, Judge chose boldly. She fled. Her feet brought her, eventually, to Elizabeth Freeman's New England, where she evaded capture and lived free until her death. Black women's history cannot be reduced to simply a tale of America's many injustices. Yes, studying the lives of black women certainly illuminates the many ways the revolutionary promise so ardently expressed by the nation's founders, just paces from the President's House exhibit, have yet to be fully realized. But to speak of black women as only our sorrow is also dehumanizing. Women like Elizabeth Freeman and Ona Judge were savvy political thinkers, brave advocates for liberty, and change agents for their own free lives, whether America was ready for them or not. When asked in her old age why she left the Washingtons and chose a life evading capture, Judge told her interviewer, Reverend T.H. Adams, that she wanted to be free. And so did Elizabeth Freeman. So did every enslaved mother, sister, grandmother, aunt who fled the British lines, and the black women of Philadelphia who helped Ona Judge escape, and the generations who followed, including present-day Philadelphians who have protested the exhibit's removal with their own exhibit, including handmade signage and copies of the original educational signs. Learn all history. Tell the truth. Slavery is part of U.S. history. Learn from the past or repeat it. Then as now, we continue to hold the nation's collective feet to the fire. That was the Ms. Magazine essay titled, She Wanted to Be Free, Black Women's Revolutionary Resistance. This was written by Vanessa Holden and published March 26, 2026. My next reading is titled, Long Before Abraham Lincoln, Virginia's Last Royal Governor Issued His Own Emancipation Proclamation. Here's what happened next. This was written by David Poole and was published November 18, 2025, in the Cardinal News, which serves Southwest and Southern Virginia. Virginia's rebellion reached the point of no return in June 1775 when a mob in Williamsburg rampaged through the governor's palace, one of the finest buildings on the continent and a symbol of Great Britain's domain. The royal-appointed governor, Lord Dunmore, fled to the safety of a warship anchored in the York River. No one in the British government would have thought less of Dunmore if he had abandoned Virginia and set sail for England, as the governors of other colonies had done. But Dunmore decided to stay and fight. It was a long shot at best. Most of Virginia's planter class had resisted against Britain's tax policies and constraints on Western expansion. Acting in extra-legal fashion, Virginians had appointed representatives to the Continental Congress and voted to establish a state militia in defiance of British rule. As shots rang out to the north in Lexington and Concord, Virginia moved inexorably from airing grievances to the cusp of declaring independence. In standing his ground, Dunmore was driven by a sense of duty. an impetuous personality, and a self-confidence that lapsed into arrogance. Less than a year earlier, Dunmore had led Virginia troops to a minor but clear victory against Native Americans in the Ohio Valley. The brief campaign, which came to be known as Dunmore's War, may have left the Scotsman with an inflated sense of his skills as a military leader. To restore British authority, Dunmore would need a force much larger than the small fleet of ships that carried an estimated 300 sailors, soldiers, and Loyalist volunteers. He could not expect Britain to send reinforcements. He would have to mobilize his own army. As he anchored in the Elizabeth River, adjacent to Loyalist strongholds of Portsmouth and Norfolk, the most significant influx of manpower was an estimated 100 runaway slaves who offered their service in return for freedom. The huge risks taken by enslaved black people in search of liberty inspired Dunmore in November 1775 to issue an astounding proclamation, which underscored the Virginia's differing meanings of liberty in the Revolutionary War. Some historians have described Dunmore's proclamation as a precursor to the Emancipation Proclamation, which 88 years later, President Abraham Lincoln would use to define the American Civil War as a clear moral crusade against slavery. Dunmore's proclamation briefly let him gain the high moral ground by drawing attention to the fact that Virginia's quest for liberty was championed by enslavers. But Dunmore, himself a slave owner, was motivated primarily by strategic considerations. His emancipation order was not universal. It applied only to able-bodied men who were owned by rebelling colonists and who were willing to enlist in his army. The offer of freedom was not extended to women, children, or any enslaved person owned by loyalists. To Dunmore, liberty was a deal, not an inalienable right. Within days of the proclamation, several hundred more slaves slipped away from their owners and took refuge with Dunmore's fleet. Dunmore accepted them all, even women and children. Between 1,000 to 1,500 slaves eventually ran away and joined his ranks. But the vast majority of the estimated 222,000 enslaved black laborers in Virginia were unable or unwilling to respond to his offer. His proclamation proved to be a strategic blunder of the highest order. Dunmore's gambit to arm slaves against their former masters galvanized support for independence among white Virginians, even moderate planters who had been inclined to remain loyal to Britain. "Men of all ranks resent the pointing a dagger to their throats through the hands of their slaves," declared Archibald Carey of Chesterfield County. No other document, not even Thomas Paine's Common Sense or the Declaration of Independence, did more than Dunmore's proclamation to convert white residents of Britain's most popular colony to the cause of independence, observed Virginia-born historian Woody Halton. In the colonial period, the fear of slave insurrection was a daily fact of life for white Virginians. Whites living on large, isolated plantations in Tidewater were outnumbered by their black enslaved workers. To many, any gathering of slaves could be considered an uprising in the making. In fact, 3 years earlier, during a debate on curtailing the transatlantic slave trade, Dunmore referenced the specter of a catastrophic slave insurrection. Many Virginia planters at the time wanted Great Britain to increase the tax on imported African slaves. While they couched their arguments in moral terms, historians say their true motivation in curtailing the transatlantic slave trade was economic self-interest and desire for domestic tranquility. With the tobacco boom over, planters feared that additional labor would dilute the value of their existing slave holdings, and some believed that Africans who had known freedom in their home country would be more likely to stir up trouble. Planter William Byrd warned that if Virginia's slave population were to continue to grow, black insurgents would tinge our rivers as wide as they are with blood. Parliament rejected Virginia's request for a tax increase. But in 1772, a year after Dunmore was posted to Williamsburg, the Virginia House of Burgesses tried again. Dunmore pleaded their case in correspondence with his superiors in London. He noted that the high concentration of slaves represented a security risk that a foreign power might seize to exploit. He said that blacks resented their situation and were ready to join the first enemy that would encourage them to revenge themselves. Compelled by desperation, Dunmore came to represent white Virginia's worst nightmare. Patriotic newspapers were quick to publish the proclamation in its entirety. To deter runaways, local patrols were increased. Newspapers speculated that Dunmore had cruel intentions, asserting he intended to sell runaway slaves to Caribbean sugar plantations, where conditions could be harsher than those in Virginia. There also was speculation that runaways would leave behind wives and children who could be subject to reprisal. The largest howls against Dunmore were accusations about how he provisioned his fleet. "Lord Dunmore sails up and down the river," a Norfolk resident wrote to a friend in England, "and where he finds a defenseless place, he lands, plunders the plantation, and carries off the Negroes." Accusations of piracy shredded any remaining legitimacy of Dunmore's authority. Patriotic newspapers derided him as "our African friend." Dunmore's combined white and black troops never grew quite large enough to quell the rebellion. A military setback at Great Bridge soon forced the fleet to abandon Norfolk. His situation became hopeless, however. Then an outbreak of smallpox ravaged his followers. Runaway slaves suffered the worst. By the summer of 1776, Dunmore was forced to give up the fight for Virginia. His diminished fleet set sail for New York in August, a month after the Continental Congress issued the Declaration of Independence. After Dunmore exited the scene, domestic tranquility was restored in Virginia. Enslaved Virginians would have to wait nearly another century for their freedom. In fact, by 1781, the Commonwealth began to offer slaves as bounties for men who enlisted in the Continental Army. Historian Jim Picouch noted that enslaved Virginians effectively became currency for white Virginians' quest for liberty. That was the article titled, "Long Before Abraham Lincoln, Virginia's Last Royal Governor Issued His Own Emancipation Proclamation." Here's what happened next. This was written by David Poole and was published November 18, 2025, in the Cardinal News at its cardinalnews.org website, which serves Southwest and Southern Virginia. I found my next reading at the website for the Arizona Daily Star newspaper out of Tucson, Arizona, and its Tucson.com website. But it was originally published at the website NorthJersey.com. It was written by Jim Beckerman, and it's titled, "They Fought for More Than Just America, the Black Troops of 1776. This was published June 20th, 2026. There's something about a soldier, something about the crisp uniform, the erect posture, the disciplined movements, the upturned eyes, something that says, I am a man, not a slave. The manly, soldierly type is looked at with a lot of respect in our society, said historical interpreter Kevin Chapman. So it's not hard to imagine what it might mean to a person of color in the slaveholding America of 1776. I'm no longer just some black person at the lower end of the spectrum working at menial jobs, Chapman said. I fought for this country. I bled for this country. I am a veteran. It's a perspective Chapman tries on for size, along with his buff-colored hunting jacket and his tall regimental hat with the ostrich plume, each time he joins his colleagues at a meeting of the 1st Rhode Island Regiment, based at Trenton, New Jersey, part of the 6th United States Colored Troops Reenactors Incorporated. This is the only black Revolutionary War reenactor unit in the United States. And right now, on the eve of the semi-quincentennial, America's 250th birthday this July 4th, they're more than usually busy. We are booked almost every weekend throughout the year, Chapman said. Some 5,000 non-white enlistees are believed to have served on the patriot side in the American Revolution. It's a part of history that, now more than ever, is at risk of being papered over. Not just because it's a fine example of American diversity at a time when diversity is officially suspect, but also because it calls attention to another, less comfortable fact, that three times as many black people, 15,000 or more, enlisted on the British side. And who can blame them? The British were more consistently explicit about the opportunity to earn their freedom, said educator Brad Fay, a program director for the National Washington Rochambeau Revolutionary Rout Association. Fay, as a public educator, and Chapman, as a reenactor, both have an abiding interest in the 1st Rhode Island Regiment. Sometimes it's called Varnum's Regiment, after the general who organized it, and sometimes called the Black Regiment, after the fact that, at a crucial juncture, it was composed substantially of people of color. That is a rare thing in the Revolution, Chapman said. Members of that unit were present during a famous and famously bloody episode in Yorktown, the October 14, 1781 assault on Redoubt 10, in which 400 Continental soldiers, led by Alexander Hamilton, overwhelmed a key British outpost. The soldiers were ordered to remove the flint from their muskets. A single accidental discharge might ruin the surprise attack. It's a moment recalled in the musical Hamilton. Take the bullets out of your gun. We move undercover and move as one. The assault on Redoubt 10 was badass, Chapman said. They fixed bayonets. You have pioneers in the lead with axes. You're charging and you're not stopping. This is brutal, hand-to-hand, nasty, you-remember-the-guy-you-killed sort of combat. They were in it to kill. 2 days later, British General Charles Cornwallis surrendered. The war was over. People of color served elsewhere and in other ways, sometimes complicated, contradictory ones. Some were sent as substitutes for masters who didn't want to fight. Others actively enlisted. Some were camp followers, musicians, cooks, couriers, dish diggers. Others, especially as the war dragged on, saw combat. The use of black soldiers was very controversial on the American side, Fay said. There was opposition, particularly coming from the South. The idea of literally arming black men to fight seemed like a bad idea to many white officers. At first, in 1775, George Washington opposed the idea of non-white troops. By the end of the year, with the war going against him, he changed his mind. The British, meanwhile, saw an opportunity. Lord Dunmore's proclamation of November 1775 offered freedom to enslaved people who were willing to take up arms against Americans. Eventually, both sides would dangle promises of freedom to get enslaved people to enlist. But which horse to back? You have African Americans trying to decode this, said Millery Polinay, associate professor of Caribbean and American Studies at New York University. Both sides are dangling this carrot, he said. But who would uphold the promise? That wasn't as clear. Many in bondage, Fay said, weren't weighing sides so much as taking the first opportunity that presented itself. It's not necessarily the case that there were two recruiters calling and saying, "Join our side," Fay said. Many people of color in that era were living difficult lives, whether they were enslaved or free. They likely joined the war based on whichever opportunity presented itself first. What is likely true is that enslaved people in 1776 could sense an opening. The nation that oppressed them, monolithic and all-powerful, had begun to crack. Americans were warring against themselves. Perhaps that was a chance. You see this infighting among whites, Polinay said. This is an opportunity. In what ways can we potentially benefit from this break that's happening at the moment? Just how many non-whites served and who they were is not easy to know. More than two centuries have buried their stories. So has their own outsider status. So did generations of historians, prompted by racial bias. Modern researchers have their work cut out for them. But there was one happy accident that gives us a glimpse of the reality on the ground. In July 1780, some 10,000 French troops arrived in Newport, Rhode Island, under the command of General Comte de Rochambeau. The French were here to help with the American Revolution, Fay said. The war had been turning into a stalemate, and there needed to be a decisive blow. The French trained with the Americans, working with them, got to know them, and the French officers, many highly educated and without the specific racial animus of Americans raised in a slave system, were able to record what they saw with some objectivity. One French officer, Baron von Clausen, was there when the French troops marched south and met up for the first time with Washington's army at White Plains, New York. Clausen specifically noted the number of black troops among Washington's men, not just in the 1st Rhode Island, but many other units as well. It was really painful to see these brave men, almost naked, with only some trousers and little linen jackets, most of them without stockings, Clausen wrote in a letter. But would you believe it, very cheerful and healthy in appearance. A quarter of them were Negroes, merry, confident, and sturdy. Whether Clausen's one-quarter estimate is accurate, and just what he meant by the term Negro, has been debated. Almost certainly he was including Native Americans and others. But merry, confident, and sturdy? That says a lot. And it's not something that would have been said, most likely, by a white American. I think this is a really good example of a contemporary original source, and I think it should be taken fairly seriously, Fay said. The movement from Rhode Island to White Plains was part of the grand climactic march of the war, some 680 miles from Newport to Yorktown, Virginia, from June to September 1781. Altogether, more than 10,000 French and 7,000 American troops participated in an advance that took them through 9 states. That's what the W3R's Victory Towns 250 project, spearheaded by Fay, is all about. Historic markers are being encouraged in the towns that the troops on the Washington-Rochambeau Trail were known to have passed through. The number of towns is high because the troops, as they moved through the state, fanned out to disguise their numbers. The troops proceeded, by foot, by horse, by ship, to Yorktown and to their date with fate. And the rest, they say, is history. It's important to remember, Pauline points out, that the American Revolution didn't happen in a vacuum. In fact, it touched off a wave of revolutionary fervor that swept the globe in the 18th century, culminating in the overthrow of the French monarchy in 1789 and the revolution in Haiti in 1791 under their own George Washington, Toussaint Louverture. And many of the black soldiers who fought in that uprising got their training here. Some 500 free black troops from Saint-Dominique fought alongside the French during the 1779 Siege of Savannah, another episode in which soldiers of color played a key role. And they took what they learned back to Haiti, where they fought for and ultimately achieved an independent nation, the first founded by enslaved people. You have some of these future revolutionaries who participated in the volunteer infantry with the French for the American side, said Pauline, whose family is from Haiti. What are some of the lessons they may have gotten from those early days, he said. That's really interesting to think about. What, meanwhile, happened to America's black soldiers afterwards? Some white officers on both sides honored their promise of freedom. Others on both sides reneged and returned the enslaved to their former masters. One notable and notably sad case was that of Samuel Sutphin. Sutphin joined up because his master said, "Go in my place, and I will free you after the war," Chapman said. Sam couldn't have given a damn about liberty and British tyranny. He just knows that he'd rather not be a slave. Alas, Sutphin didn't get it in writing. "I believed the white man's word, hoping to be free when the fight was over," he said to have said. "I took no paper to show the bargain, but trusted to my master." Between 1776 and 1778, Sutphin saw action many times, including the Battle of Long Island, was wounded in the leg, and was commended by his superior officers. "He fights and he fights well," Chapman said. Then he returned home to claim his promise, only to discover, as Supreme Court Justice Roger B. Taney famously put it in 1757, that a black man has no rights which the white man was bound to respect. After the war, the master reneges on his freedom, and he's a slave for another 20 years, Chapman said, which is awful. There is, if not a happy ending, at least a kind of closure. Sutphin, after 2 decades, was finally able to buy his own freedom. He won a $50 annual military pension from the state of New Jersey. And he won, Chapman said, the esteem of his neighbors, which for a former slave is no small thing. The War of 1776, at the outset, had seemed to promise much: freedom for slaves who were willing to fight, an anti-slavery clause later stricken in the Declaration of Independence itself, but it wasn't enough. The American Revolution ended in 1783. The Emancipation Proclamation wasn't signed into law until 1863, 80 more years of slavery. But there was this too: a memory of military service, military pride, in the histories of more than a few black families. All the brutal masters, all the injustice in the world can't unring that bell. That was the article titled, "They Fought for More Than Just America, the Black Troops of 1776. This was written by Jim Beckerman and published June 20th, 2026. Originally at the website northjersey.com and reprinted at the website of the Arizona Daily Star, which is tucson.com. My next reading is titled, Scholars Angela Davis and Jelani Cobb Gift Wisdom and Inspire Intergenerational Reflections at Brooklyn Public Library. This was published July 3, 2026, in the Our Times Press newspaper. This story was written by the editors. A milestone recognition of the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States and the signing of the Declaration of Independence, the Brooklyn Public Library's 2026 Con Humanities Series invited two of the country's leading scholars and educators, Angela Davis and Jelani Cobb, to share thoughts about the document and the celebration. Framed by activist Professor Davis's extensive work and commitment as an advocate for the oppressed and civil rights, human rights, and women's rights activists for more than six decades, the conversation was guided by Pulitzer-nominated journalist historian Professor Cobb, Dean of the Columbia School of Journalism. Jelani Cobb. Commemorations are often as much about the current moment as they are about the moment being commemorated. We talk about the contradictions of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, which led directly to the Civil War. And when you look at the Civil War, the kind of summation we make of it is that there's one side that's fighting to preserve slavery, the other side fighting to preserve the Union. Both staked a claim to 1776. We rarely grapple with the Confederate argument that they were the true heirs to what the founders had been trying to create in 1776. Angela Davis. Remember the collective sentiment in 2020 when more people than ever before in our history of this country went out into the streets to stand up about racism. And you know, of course, we can talk about all of the moments that led up to that surge. This may be a somewhat simplistic analysis, but it felt like masses of people in this country, stimulated by the possibility of real democracy, were really ready to move forward, to take that step. But we hadn't really taken into consideration what would be necessary in order to challenge counterforces. There were others who were very much aware of the potential of what was happening. Conservative forces have been planning, you know, for decades to try to seize the time, to grab the reins of history. I think we were kind of naive. We weren't really doing the work that would allow us to counteract the counter-revolutionary forces. I think we need to learn from that, because that was a moment when we really could have seized the time, but we didn't do it in 2020. There may come another conjuncture, and we need to be more prepared. If we want to talk about the promise of the Declaration of Independence, the promise of democracy, it has been black people and other people of color. It has been women of all racial backgrounds. It has been working class people, regardless of their racial background, who have actually pushed for the broadening of the sense of democracy that is instilled in the Declaration of Independence. Jelani Cobb. So I think one of the interesting paradoxical points here is that there are these obvious contradictions. In the first draft of the Declaration, Jefferson lists a litany of offenses that warrant separation from the British crown, mentions the transatlantic slave trade, which he refers to as an execrable traffic in human beings, and then they copy-edit that line out, so that the version of the document that is signed does not have any objection to the transatlantic slave trade. And he does that to make the document more palatable to southern colonies, to make sure that they're willing to sign on to this. But at the same time, here's the paradoxical part. The declaration is cited in the Haitian Revolution, the French Revolution, by Ho Chi Minh, and the Vietnamese struggle against the French before the Americans were even involved in that conflict. The declaration is cited by independent strugglers throughout Latin America. This idea of anti-colonial consciousness connects to that document. Angela Davis. Let's also remember that the document is cited in relation to women's suffrage and the 1905 Niagara Movement's Declaration of Principles, the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. So how does that work? I think that is about ways of finding potential, of finding promise. It is the founding document of this place that we inhabit. We have a responsibility not only to try to understand it, but also the ways in which it has been utilized, both productively and sometimes quite unproductively. I would suggest that we try to hold on to the tension and the contradictions that are inherent. As people who live in the United States, we have been educated to want to find ways to move beyond contradictions, to find an analysis and an approach that doesn't require us to take note. We look at these moments of promise that only apply to a limited number of people, and we demand an expansiveness of the very freedom that is narrowed in that document. In the words of Marian Kaba, paraphrasing, hope is not just a feeling. Optimism is not a feeling. It's a practice. It's discipline. And I've concluded that one of the tasks of the organizer is to create that hope, is to help generate that hope, to help people acquire a sense of the collective power they wield. I've been accused of being an inveterate optimist, but I'm not an optimist who does not pay attention to the need to do the kind of cold analysis that allows us to recognize where we are. That was the article titled, Scholars Angela Davis and Jelani Cobb Gift Wisdom and Inspire Intergenerational Reflections at Brooklyn Public Library. This was written by the editors of the Our Times Press and published July 3rd, 2026. That's all for this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the archives at the Audio Reader Network of the University of Kansas at the website reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.